Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
An Erio's original.
Each week, we decide who's to blame for a historical tragedy. And each week, you tell us if we got it right. My name is Rebecca Delgado-Smith, and this is The Aftermath. The Aftermath. Hey, everyone. Thanks for tuning into this episode of The Aftermath. Today, we're speaking with Dr. Juan S. La Rosa Fuentes. Juan is a researcher in the Department of Sociocultural Study at ITESO University and a professor at the School of Journalism and Public Communication. In 2018, he published his paper, Journalistic Narratives and Collective Memory of an Urban Catastrophe, the Case of the April 22nd Explosion in the Guadalajara Press. Let's hear what he has to say about the 1992 Guadalajara explosions. Hi, Juan. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, I'm very glad to be here. Thanks.
Well, welcome. Could you start off by giving our listeners a rundown on your research focus and in the study of communication?
Yes. Well, I'm being a research scholar for the last 10 years, and my research is mainly focused on political communication, journalism, and history of media. So my work is about what's happening here in the Mexican media, but also about elections and how journalists do their job. So basically, that's the universe where I move on.
Shifting gears a little here to talk about the disaster. By April 19, 1992, residents of downtown Guadalajara's Reforma district had already started to complain to local authorities about the strong gasoline smell coming from the sewage pipes. And then by the 21st of April, the odor was making headlines. What was the response to these complaints?
Well, I think that the personnel of the municipality and people from the state government, they sent some people to register what was happening. But what we know now is that they failed to really measure the risk of what was happening, and they failed to take action very quick. They would have to evacuate all the people that were living in that part of the city, and that would save many lives. But they were very slow at their assessment of the situation. And then it happened, this big explosion that killed many, many people.
And walk us how at 10 a.m. the explosion began. This was on the 22nd, the next day. What were some of the accounts from those who experienced this disaster?
I mean, it was in the morning, and there was some this very conservative politician that many years later said that God was operating at that moment, because it was after the time that the people were traveling to work and to school. So the streets were more or less empty, in the sense that all the people were already working or at their school. So it was before 10 a.m. And suddenly the blocks and the concrete of all that part of the city started to just explode. And it was several blocks that were this. And people were very scared. They were trying to figure out what was happening. And suddenly that part of the city became like a war zone. There were like big holes, and many of the buildings were just teared down. And people were trying to look for the relatives. And fortunately, it was not. If the explosions were like 1 or 2 hours before, there would be more casualties.
Now, what was the initial response to the explosion from the government officials when it all started?
Well, it was a lot of confusion. I think that there were no protocols about how to react to these kind of situations. We had like a very young Protección Civil, which is like civil protection brigade, and they really didn't know how to react. And this had a similar pattern what happened with the 1985 earthquake in Mexico City that also devastated the capital of the country. And in both occasions, in the earthquake and in the explosions, what happened here is that people like society, like the community, were the one who were in charge of rescuing people. They started to get organized. They started to start making holes in the ground and taking all the materials from the ground to start helping people going out. The government response was really, really slow. Was really politicized, and they were also trying to control the image of what was happening, because the ultimate responsible was this state-controlled enterprise, which is Pemex, which is the one who controls the oil here in Mexico. And they were responsible for what happened. So they were trying to not make a lot of fuss about this, but it was impossible to not do that, because it was a really big explosion and many people were dying. So where the people was actually the one who solved the problem, or who was in charge of dealing with this problem in the first days and hours.
Can you help us understand Pemex's role in the disaster? And did their monopoly of gasoline in Mexico and perhaps their alleged embezzlement have anything to do with the situation, how the situation was handled?
Sure. I mean, Pemex is a state monopoly in Mexico. Nowadays, we have, is not the only one who is in the market. There are many other firms, but during the 90s, there was only Pemex, and Pemex was the one who controlled everything about oil in Mexico. So they had this big refinery, or not refinery, like this big plant, but it was inside of the city. So that was the first problem. And it was not near to the wealthiest part of the city, as you would imagine. It was near to... Like the lowest income people in the city. Uh-huh. And in that moment, we didn't know that. But 30 years later, we know that during that time, it started to, Pemex had a big problem about like criminal gangs trying to steal oil. So what they do now, and now it's a big problem, is that they make holes in the tubes and the pipes of where the oil goes. So they did this this hole. We still don't know exactly who did that. It's like a mix between people inside Pemex and people outside, because it's a big net of corruption. I mean, criminals cannot act alone. They need to have people inside the company to do these kind of things. And they didn't control that leak. And the leak just started to go to the sewers of that part of the city. And it became a bomb. And we don't actually know what happened. It could be like, I don't know, like a stove or something lighting a match, and then everything blow out. So it was a mix between corruption and people trying to steal that kind of oil from Pemex.
Wow. So, I mean, the officials at the time were quick to point fingers at the local cooking oil company, La Central. Was there any culpability there? Was this an attempt to distract from the narrative that was inevitably evolving?
Yeah, I mean, the thing is that they wanted to find really, really soon responsibles, but they didn't want to make a big investigation, a big research about this, because there were many people involved here, and it would be like a very complicated process for the whole state. So they just focus on local people, which La Central is part of Pemex. And at the end, the official version is that Pemex was responsible for the catastrophe, but we don't know exactly who was responsible. At the end, the mayor of Guadalajara was in jail for almost 10 years, I think, and some other people went to jail, but we really exactly we don't know what happened. We don't have like for sure this research about exactly like. What I'm telling you is like some of the best speculations of what we know would happen, but we don't have really, really a technical truth of what happened at the moment. So in the paper I wrote, in sociological terms, I explained that it's still like a wound open, because we, as a society, we haven't had a closure of what happened there. Many of the people who lost their lives or lost some members of their body or got injured, they still don't have a repair from the state. And so it's still a process that it's open. So at that moment, they focus on local authorities, but they really didn't want to go up in the ladder of chain.
In your paper, you state that it is for us to begin to understand what happened, we must describe and analyze the changes in our daily lives. In this process of analysis and reconstruction in the wake of the disaster, the act of remembering plays a crucial role in finding meaning. In narrating the past, individuals and society can begin to understand causes and consequences of a tragedy like what happened in Guadalajara. This is very interesting to me, because this is what we're doing here on the podcast. You know, we're remembering historical events and trying to continue to understand them. How do you think that this exercise helps us as a society process, and what role do journalists play in doing so?
Well, this is very important, because the way we make sense of the past is the way we can deal with our present. So in this case, when we don't have any assurance of what really happened, and when we have a weak state that cannot held accountable for people that are responsible of what happened, and especially when we don't have the opportunity to express ourselves in the sense of making monuments or crying for the people who were lost in our way, it makes a fracture in the collective memory, in the sense that we still, every year, we're still mourning to those people, but we really don't know what happened to them. And many of them, and there are many people who are still alive, they have the tragedy inside their bodies because they lost one arm or they lost one leg. And they say that every day that they take a shower, for example, and they see that they don't have the leg or the arm, they remember what happened that day. And they remember that they're like, the wound is still open. So what many of these people want, and many of these collectives want, is to make this investigation, and at the end, to know what really happened and to help people accountable. And in this sense, journalists, the work of journalists is very important because it's like a ritual. Every year, Mexican journalists, especially in Guadalajara, they go every year to the same part of the city to report what's happening there. And they know exactly what is going to happen. It's not about the breaking news, but they go every year to the church where they have this mass. And when they, in the mass, they remember the people. And then after the mass, they march in a silent march to downtown. And journalists go with all these people and report what's happening. And then the journalists go again to that part of the city and report how a new wall just was covered, part of the disaster, of how the signs of the disaster are just blurring, and how people is starting to forget about this because it's starting to get many, many decades now. I'm 41, and I was at the moment, I was like 12 years old. So many of my students don't know what happened because they weren't alive, and that memory is fading. So that's the importance of journalism.
How was the disaster reported outside of Mexico?
Well, I mean, in that moment, we still have like the one ruling party in Mexico. So it was a very controlled press in the rest of the country. Many people describe it as semi-authoritarian. It's not like a total control, but many people like didn't know at the moment what was happening, and they also tried to control what was happening outside in Mexico. So what I reviewed at the moment is that there was not a lot of coverage of what was happening. It was kind of a curious thing, or like this scary thing that happened in other part of the world, like a very short coverage, like 1 minute, like, oh, see what's happening in Guadalajara. Oh, what's scary. Okay, now let's go and see what's happening in the weather. So it was not like a very a full coverage, a robust coverage. But then I know that many companies have come to report what happened. Like I know that there's a story in Discovery Channel, and there are like many documentaries about what happened because it was really, really a big disaster in terms of urban terms, and that it can happen in many other in other cities. And actually, I can say that this is not a totally solved problem in Guadalajara. At some point, like we still have like, oh, like it's, we have this smell in the sewers. What's happening? And they go and like, there's still some things wow. there. And then, they now know how to deal with that. But I think it's not like something that we have just rid of because there are very old pipes and many things that needs to be repaired. So we are in a thing that we're not totally safe. I mean, I'm not saying that it's going to explode tomorrow, but I think that that's the other thing that we haven't like deal with that, like saying like, hey, we have to take out this company from here. It hasn't to be near to to the city, and we need to change all the pipes, and that we haven't done that.
Wow. So at the end of the day, I always ask our experts, if you had to pick one person or thing, it could be a concept, that is to blame for the deadly 1992 Guadalajara explosions, who or what would that be?
Corruption. I would say that it's corruption, because I think that Pemex has always been a very corrupt company, in the sense that it has been like the golden eggs chicken for Mexico. Like it's been so wealthy in terms of oil that all the time they are extracting not only oil from the soil, but also the money that that oil produces, and not for the people. Many are for financing elections and stuff. And many times they cut the budget to have safe places to work. So that's part of the reasons of why this disaster occurred. And also corruption in the government, because we as a state haven't been able after all these decades to really go to terms of what happened, in the sense like saying, okay, this is what really happened, A, B, and C. And then we're going to hold accountable people, no matter who is that. And then we're going to repair to the victims all this damage. And then we're going to change all this system of extracting oil with Pemex and making a safer company and a safer environment. And I think all that, it's just getting in front of trying to end with all this thing, it's corruption.
Well, Juan, thank you so much for joining us today and helping us understand this terrible disaster. And I promise to keep remembering all of the, make sure everyone doesn't forget.
Oh, thank you so much, Rebecca, for the opportunity of talking with you and all the people who are listening. And I appreciate the space for talking about this.
With us today, we have producer Amanda Lund.
Hello, Rebecca. Hello, Alarmy.
And fact checker Chris Smith.
Hi.
I just have to say my jaw was dropped when he was talking about the corruption inside of Pemex. I mean, I'm so glad we had Juan on.
Because we were thinking, I mean, and he even said this is still like there hasn't been a verdict, right? Which is so frustrating for everyone involved, but. I mean, we kind of brushed off the corruption inside of Pemex as like super speculative, but it sounds like there's a little bit more to it than that. And yeah, it was really crazy to hear.
Yeah, we definitely touched on that. I think the one, yeah, I would agree with Amanda. I think the one thing that sort of resonated with me was how real the pain is of not having closure for one of these things, especially because when you look at, because we do a lot of... you know, I don't know, environmental disasters or disasters that are sort of out of people's control, natural disasters, right? And in those cases, you know, there's fallout and there are problems with responses. But in this case, something happened that caused this. This was not natural. This was something happened. And the fact that they are not able or perhaps refuse to get to the bottom of it or just there's too much unknown about it is it makes it even more tragic.
Yeah, and the fact that also Juan was saying that the government, their first, they were slow to react in their emergency response, but what they did do was start to try to like do press and like cover up their involvement and like pass the buck, and that the citizens were the ones who had to sort of deal with the actual emergency response is just so frustrating. So I don't know what you think about our verdict, Rebecca. What were your overall thoughts?
Well, I was struck by the, you know, information about the gangs drilling holes. That to me was shocking, in that it was a big problem at the time where it just reeks of corruption, right? Because the government is covering up these gangs that were essentially stealing from within, and just like how that little hole, because we remember in the episode we kept saying, how is it possible that this little hole, you know, caused such a big disaster, and how did that hole get there? Like, that explaining how that little hole could have gotten there, to me was shocking. You know, just the idea that these people are stealing gasoline and just leaving holes in the sewage system around the city, and in the aftermath, you know, he was explaining that the system hasn't even been replaced or fixed. It could, mm-hmm. it was very upsetting, definitely.
Yeah.
To hear. I think that we got it right. I wish I had known more about the gangs and what was happening, like, inside that kind of corruption. But of course, if the press is so controlled coming out of the country and coming out of the disaster, I can see how, that was kind of like brushed under the rug.
Right.
But I think ultimately that still falls under corruption. So I feel like we sadly hit the nail on the head.
Yeah. So we sent government corruption to jail and we slapped Primex.
Pemex.
Yeah. So that's, I think, I mean, that sounds good to me.
Yeah.
I'm glad we, you know, we normally don't get it right. So it felt, I felt like, oh, okay, we did our best on this one. we got it a little, we understood at least a little bit.
Maybe we should be interviewing ourselves for expert for some of these episodes, because we're getting there. I mean,
yeah,
you get 100 episodes under your belt, Amanda, and technically I think Malcolm Gladwell said you're an expert in something. No, what is his rule?
It's 10,000 hours.
10,000 hours. So we don't have that yet.
No,
we're all pretty advanced. So I mean, maybe, I don't know, we can probably do it in 5,000 hours.
5,000.
Oh, between the three of us. Then we
true.
Just,
yeah, you.
Yeah, I guess we have 3.3. We just need 3,300 hours. we'll get there. We'll get there. But yeah, no, I feel good with our verdict here. And you know what he was talking about? How, like, it dawned on me that we love to blame because it helps us process and, you know, hopefully move on, right? And it just dawned on me. I was like, oh, that's why it feels so good.
Yeah, even though we're doing this just in our own minds.
Yeah.
And it's like, it really is satisfying. And you walk away from these episodes, and I hope people do who are listening at home, feeling like, you know, a little bit of a weight off.
Yeah, I feel like we should get a Peabody. Anybody else?
I would agree.
I mean, I wouldn't, like, reject it.
I mean, if anybody in the Alarmy knows any... And I don't mean to skip directly to corruption, but if they know anybody on the Peabody board, maybe slip our name in there and give us a few extra ticks. I don't know how they do the voting there, but if you can kind of sneak us in there, I feel like we deserve it. But I don't know how to do it. So maybe if somebody could hook us up, that would be cool.
Have you not learned anything, Chris?
Look, if...
I know, especially from our Olympics episode.
Yeah, that's right. Remember?
Yeah.
The in the Olympics, they, I mean, everyone's cheating. So might as well join in on the fun. Hey.
Well, we'll see. We'll see if we get that email. Well, thank you to Juan. And as always, thank you to Chris and Amanda and the entire Alarmy. We're together. We are getting down to the bottom of who's to blame for all of history's greatest tragedies.
That's right.
So.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
And now, our interview with Oliver Catlin. Oliver has been working in the arena of sports, anti-doping science, and dietary supplement research and testing for more than 15 years. He is the president of Banned Substances Control Group. Let's hear what he has to say about the Russian Olympic doping scandal. Hi, Oliver. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Good morning. Thank you, Rebecca. Appreciate it.
So, could you start off by giving our listeners a little background on your anti-doping research and work?
Sure. I'm Oliver Catlin. I'm the president of Banned Substances Control Group. I've been working in and around this field for a little bit more than 17 years. I cut my teeth at the UCLA Olympic Analytical Laboratory, which is the lab my dad started in 1982 to do drug testing for the Los Angeles Olympic Games. And the laboratory grew into the largest of its kind in the world over his career and serviced not just the Olympics, but also the NFL, the NCAA, minor league baseball, and U.S. military and others. So it's been certainly a rewarding ride through anti-doping for 17 years.
So has doping always been prevalent among athletes in the Olympics? When did it start becoming a problem or really popping up?
I mean, there's been a history of use of substances to enhance performance as long as the Olympic Games have really been around. It stretches way back to ancient times where they were using herbs to run faster and farther. But obviously it's been modernized in its current form with the World Anti-Doping Agency and the World Anti-Doping Agency prohibited list. That structure has been around for about 20 years or so by now.
And why was the was WADA, the World Anti-Doping Agency, started in 1999 by the International Olympic Committee?
There was really a desire to have an independent approach, an organization that could marshal anti-doping activities around the world. And so that had been previously managed by the IOC Medical Commission. And so that was separated and given as a sole role for the World Anti-Doping Agency to continue to pursue and grow.
And what was the purpose for the organization initially or still?
It's really to handle the anti-doping rules and regulations that are in place for the Olympic movement and any of the signatories to the Olympic movement. So other sports can sign and say that they will use those same rules in the course of their own sports. So that's been done in places like golf and other realms. Tennis have adopted those same rules. So that's the structure that essentially governs amateur sport
and anti-doping for the amateur sport environment.
Now, speaking more specifically about the Russian doping scandal, I'd like to talk about the director of the Moscow drug testing lab, Grigory Rodchenkov.
Sure, Grigory.
Yeah, who is said to have been the architect of the Russian team's cheating scheme at the Sochi Olympics in 2014, which we will get to in a second. Now, Rodchenkov had been working in drug testing labs since the 80s up until 2011, when he pleaded guilty to drug trafficking charges in Russia. But then in 2012, his charges are dropped and he's invited to join the testing experts for the London 2012 Olympics. What can you tell us about Rodchenkov's career up until then? And why was the London Olympics such a crucial part of the cheating scandal 2 years later?
Well, Grigory certainly has an interesting career. It does stretch back to the 80s. We, in fact, know Grigory from the 80s. He showed up as part of a U.S.-Soviet anti-doping collaboration that my father and others started in and around the, I think it was 82, 83, somewhere in there. So Grigory actually visited our laboratory here in the U.S., I met him. I was 6 or 8 years old or something at the time. But I remember it like it was yesterday. He came with some of the other folks that ran Russian sport, and they crushed my hand in the in a handshake on the patio. But I mean, it stretches back to then. He was in and around the anti-doping environment back then. There was a previous instance where people had thought that the Soviets had a doping scheme going on in and around the Seoul Olympic Games. And there was some discussion of a boat being in the harbor at those Olympics to pretest athletes to see if the drugs that they had used were still showing up in the urine samples. And if they were, then they wouldn't compete. If they weren't, then they went ahead to compete. So, I mean, the history stretches back to that sort of affair. And, you know, Grigory had become the director of the Moscow lab in 2005. So it's anybody's guess exactly what was going on in that 2005 to 2014 period. He's written a book now about it that I've read and is certainly fascinating to read and consider. But there was a lot going on. I mean, you know, he was at one point doping athletes himself with a scheme that involved putting steroids in liquor and providing them to athletes. The plan was that it would be a short acting effect of the steroid and it would clear the body quickly based on being given in that way. So there was a short window of detection for those athletes. And that was sort of his direct role in doping athletes beyond the broader scheme that that the Soviets were involved in as a whole.
And I believe he had developed technology to be able to trace substances at a longer period of time, much later on in the process.
He did. That's the ironic element of this is that that Grigory and one of his colleagues had a research paper that looked into the longer term detection of oral tarinabol, which was a steroid that was fairly common, very powerful oral steroid. So they had come up with a test that could extend the window of detection for oral tarinabol. It extended it from maybe 20 days to a period of several months. And the irony is that if you look back retrospectively, there have been a number of Russian athletes that have been caught for doping retrospectively in and around the London Games. And many of those have been caught, ironically, for oral tarinabol with this new longer-term detection method. So it was kind of fascinating that on the one hand, he's out there doping athletes, and on the other hand, him and his colleagues created some technology that's still in use today and allows the overall system to have a much longer window of detection for a fairly important drug. So.
Now, I know that we talk about the Russians, you know, because they had all this whole complicated process of how they cheated in that particular Olympics. We talk about them most. But were there other countries that were also cheating as well?
I mean, there's always that question. I think there were some questions about an African nation at the time. I forget which one, but I mean, they're not alone in doping. I think what was unique was the breadth and scope and scale of the scheme and how many people it involved throughout the realm of Russian sport. This was not a simple scheme to carry out. I mean, during the Olympic Games, they were passing samples through a hidden mouse hole that had been constructed in the laboratory. And in the room next door, there were literally Russian agents that had set up an operation to get into the urine samples, switch the urine samples with clean samples, and then feed those back into the laboratory. And at the same time, they were also aware of the what are supposed to be secret codes that the athletes get when they provide a urine sample. They're provided with a code. And those codes are typically only known by the body that does the collection. The testers aren't supposed to know it. It's only supposed to be connected with a sample when and if there's any kind of positive result found. But in this case, they knew the codes, they knew which samples to switch, and it was an elaborate scheme. And I hope that Russia was unique in perpetrating that kind of a scheme in today's general realm of sport.
Now, what was the process for them eventually being caught?
You know, it had started to come out that there were some issues. There was a German investigation that had been done on this whole issue, and Grigory had been talking fairly openly to these German producers, and so the cat was essentially out of the bag with that. And as he started to speak more and more, he became concerned about his own wealth and or health and wellness through the whole situation. Several of his colleagues that had been involved in the scheme had mysteriously passed away in the previous few months. So he was concerned for himself, and he had also started to talk to Brian Fogel, who made the Icarus documentary. And so There was a point of no return, I think, that Grigory reached where he knew he had crossed the line, the secret was out, and he was going to be a wanted man because of that. So he took an opportunity provided to him by Brian Fogel to escape the country, and the rest is history.
Now, how has the performance enhancement drug testing progressed since this scandal?
I think for listeners, it's important to realize that there have been many, many advancements in anti-doping in the last decade, particularly in the last decade. And the simplest way to understand that is in the instrument technology and in the advancement in the instrument technology. You know, 10, 15 years ago, we were able to find 2 nanograms per milliliter, 2 parts per billion in a urine sample. Today, we can find 0.5 picogram, which is 0.5 part per trillion. So we're able, by that alone, the detection window has significantly expanded just because we're simply able to find smaller amounts of drugs today than we were 10 or 15 years ago. So that has advanced the system perhaps more than any. But there have also been other advancements like the one we have been discussing, where folks look at drugs and try to find longer acting metabolites that could be a marker of use for a longer period of time. That kind of thing is always going on. And the anti-doping industry is always tracking pharmaceutical developments. And if there's concerns that come through the drug development pipeline, the community is often on top of that and developing methods to detect those drugs before they really hit the open market and become a wider concern for athletes.
Now, we always ask this question at the end of our interviews with our experts. At the end of the day, if you had to pick one person or thing, it can be a concept that you think is to blame for the Russian Olympic doping scandal, who or what would that be?
Boy, that's an interesting question. You know, we really have built the biggest and best system that we can, but this was just an unexpected occurrence. I think it's one that we need to be aware of systemically, and I think it's just something that we need to watch more as an international movement. It's hard to perpetrate these things for a long period of time without people noticing. And I think for all of us to be simply aware that something on this grand scale can occur is eye-opening and can allow us to look at systemic ways that we can protect against that occurring in the future. But, you know, I think if there was a single one person, I would probably point to, honestly, Vladimir Putin. You know, he has an opportunity here. He knows what happened. You can't turn back the clock. You can only progress. And I haven't seen all that much progress. I've seen the current situation just get kind of mired in this political question and blame game. But what the international, you know, Olympic world wants to see is that that's not going to happen again, that there's been a dedication in and around that country to change the modus operandi. And I think, you know, we shouldn't forget that, you know, it wasn't more than 30 years ago where there were some similar things going on in and around the U.S. We weren't exactly the cleanest country ourselves back in the day when anti-doping was young. So we've had to make a lot of progress ourselves as a country. We've had to become dedicated to clean sport and what it means to the athletes. And I think we've had to recognize that clean sport really has a place in sport and in solidifying its place in and around society. We don't want, none of us want Olympic athletes, whether they be Russian or anyone else, to be accused of doping, to have the Olympics marred by this kind of a discussion is incredibly disappointing for anybody who loves the Olympic Games and loves what they represent as far as international competition. So to clear all of that, I think the one person who holds the most amount of cards is Vladimir Putin.
Well, Oliver, thank you so much for joining us today. And thank you for helping to keep people honest.
You're most appreciated, and certainly it's a tough road to hoe sometimes, but it's an important one, and athletes at the end of the day really appreciate having a clean sport environment to participate in. That's why we do what we do. So.
And now to discuss, we have producer Amanda Lund.
Hello, everyone.
And fact checker Chris Smith.
Hi there.
So how do you guys feel? I feel like, you know, we kind of nailed this one.
Yes, we did send Putin to jail and we slapped regulatory theater.
That's
so
right.
I don't know what to say. We're 2 for 2 the last 2 weeks.
I have to say this one thing, which is that maybe if I could go back and do something differently, I would go back, put Putin in jail, and maybe also slap Putin while he's in jail. Doesn't Putin have just such a slappable face? Like, he does seem like one of those guys who actually could actually take a slap really well. Like, you know, like just like react really quickly and then like sort of look back at you really steely. So I feel like
you'd have to tie him down.
Sort of
otherwise, he's coming back at you. Have to tie him down. Otherwise, he's coming back at you hard.
Yeah, that's true. Exactly. You got to keep your hands up. That's for sure.
It's you just can't like get out of your fighting stance. You're just always be prepared.
You slap Putin, he's gonna knife you.
It's true.
Or someone will come up behind you and knife
maybe it
you.
Was a good idea just to put him in jail.
Just put him in jail.
Jail with our high paid very large, extra large guards.
Don't get distracted with slapping. Yeah. But, you know, I thought everything he had to say was so interesting.
My favorite thing about what he said was at the end where he talked about how appreciative the athletes were.
Right.
And that to me makes the most sense when you think about it in terms of an athlete who's doing the right thing. It's got to feel like you want somebody on your side trying to regulate everything and so that you can have a fair shot. And yeah. That makes a lot of sense to me.
Well, you know, that was a lot of fun. And thank you to everyone for listening to this episode of The Aftermath. Stay tuned because next week we are going to be discussing the Munich 1972 Olympic Massacre. Stay tuned.
Powered by Acast.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.